From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2013 when our country reached kind of a painful benchmark. More than half of the public school children in the United States were considered to be living in low-income households. More than half. And the student homeless population continues to rise. Today, more than 1.3 million kids in the U.S. are homeless. Now, with that in mind, a group of educators has put together a new conference called The Many Faces of Poverty. It's a collaboration among the College of Brockport, the Brockport Central School District, and the Institute for Poverty Studies and Economic Development at the college. And they plan to explore a wide range of subjects related to poverty and how it impacts kids. For example, what are our assumptions about complex issues like this? How do neighborhoods structure inequality? What happens when we encounter people who say that poverty is just an excuse when schools underperform? That is just for starters. There's a lot more to talk about. The inaugural conference is set for Friday, April 28th at the College at Brockport, and there are still tickets available. We'll tell you how you can get involved in just a moment. Let me go ahead and welcome my guests for the hour. Dr. Leslie Myers is back with us, the superintendent of the Brockport Central School District. Dr. Myers, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan. Glad to be here.
Dr. Celia Watt is a professor and chair of the Department of Public Administration and director of the Institute for Poverty Studies and Economic Development at the College at Brockport Metro Center. Dr. Watt, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
LaShonda Leslie Smith is here, the executive director of Connected Community Incorporated. She's going to be giving a keynote address called I Am the Face of Poverty at the upcoming conference. LaShonda, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And also here is Lisa Robusto, who is an event coordinator at the College at Brockport Metro Center. We'll have a lot to tell us about what that day is going to entail coming up. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I should have asked before the program, because I don't know the answer to this, but who can tell me, how did this come together? Whose idea was this to begin with? Dr. Myers, Dr. Watt?
I can speak to that,
yeah.
Sure. So the Institute for Poverty Studies and Economic Development at the College at Brockport has an executive committee, and Leslie Myers is on our executive committee. And as we were looking at what our goals were for this academic year, Leslie really wanted to have a conference that we could target educators and students to learn more about poverty and the impact of poverty on education. So Leslie and actually Tom Hernandez, the Dean of the School of Education and Human Services, got together and we started working on it.
And you've got a wide range of breakout sessions, and throughout this hour I'd like to kind of go step by step and talk about some of these issues. But just for example, Bridges to Success, an evidence-based model for working with people living in poverty, thinking critically about poverty and the poor, analyzing and evaluating your assumptions about complex issues, Poverty in Place, how neighborhoods structure inequality for children and families, Learn Together, Lead Together, Work Together, turning high-poverty schools into high-performing schools, The Power of PBIS in Poverty, What Can I Do, Principles of Trauma-Informed Care in Action, Poverty in Perspective, Students with Interrupted Formal Education, We Lost Everything, Urban Poverty and Refugee Resettlement, Poverty, Social Inequality, and Mental Health. So there's a wide range there, but I think we should at least also ask our panelists to tell us how you can still get involved. It's coming up, as I said, on Friday, April 28th, from 9 to 3 at the College at Brockport. Tickets still available? Yes, Lisa?
Yes, they are.
Okay. How to do that?
So you can register for the conference at the Brockport Central School District's website. They have a bcs1.org/many faces of poverty, and that is all one word, many faces of poverty. And from there, there's a quick registration link, and you can choose your breakout sessions and sign up for the conference and join us on the 28th.
All right, the morning keynote comes from LaShonda Leslie Smith, Executive Director of Connected Communities Incorporated, and it's called I Am the Face of Poverty. And you're going to tell your story, yeah?
Yes, that's what I plan to do. I am a native Rochesterian, born and raised here in this community, have experienced and been a part of many of the circumstances in which will be discussed throughout the conference. And I want to talk a little bit about from the perspective of an individual who has faced poverty head on. I was a teen mom at the age of 14. So as you can imagine, that comes with a set of circumstances that would leave one destitute in many cases, and then to be rearing a child in poverty, on welfare, really struggling, makes it very difficult for you to really see the other side of that. But I'm fortunate to have been able to accomplish many things in my life in spite of those circumstances that we were living in, my son and I. And I want to talk a little bit about that. And I want to talk a little bit about how they impacted us, how they impacted my son even, and how they're impacting many, many kids throughout our community.
No, your resume is very impressive, and I did not know the personal side of the story for you. So 14, Jimmy, do you remember what I don't remember what I was thinking at 14. You know, I mean, we're still kids at 14. Do you remember just trying to get your head around what it meant to be becoming a mother?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is I had my son in the early 90s, mm-hmm. and at the time, having a child at that age was kind of the norm, unfortunately.
Wow.
It was the time in our community where we hit an all-time high of teen pregnancy. I remember being in middle school. I was in the eighth grade when I learned that I was pregnant, just getting ready to graduate, you know. So the things that you should be concerned about in eighth grade is what dress are you going to wear underneath your cap and gown, you know, as you're walking across the stage, getting prepared to go into high school. And yet I was deciding, you know, what I was going to do with my entire life, because now I had another life that I was going to be responsible for. I had to grow up very quickly. My mother had determined that she had already raised her children, and she was not prepared to raise another one. So I needed to be responsible and get a job, whatever job you can find at 14, to be able to raise this child and take care of him. And I did that. And it was a very difficult thing. But I believe that one of the best things that my mom could have done for me was make me be responsible for my actions and take care of that child on my own, with support of extended family, of course. But in terms of who was getting up in the middle of the night to do feedings and who was changing diapers and whatnot, that was me. But I did require assistance from the Department of Social Services for Medicaid and food stamps and WIC and things like that, because obviously at 14, you cannot, you're not self-sufficient. And so it was a struggle in the middle of the wintertime with a stroller and a baby bag and a book bag and trying to get homework done in the evening with a fussy baby. It was very, very difficult. But beyond that, the financial aspect, standing on soup kitchen lines and you know, just trying to figure out what am I going to do in order to show this child that he can be everything that he wants to be when he grows up. I had to really fight for my education. I had to fight a lot to make sure that he had what he needed to sustain himself throughout the rest of his life. And we did that. We did it together.
When you look at teen parents now, well, actually, let me just back up and say, I'm sure when you're 14, you're not looking up statistics of likely outcomes in life, you know, but one of the things that we hear often is, you know, if you're 14, 15, 16, 17, and you have a child and you are, you know, potentially leaving school or thinking of all the different things that could happen to you, you know, that the outcomes are not likely to be very good. I mean, you've really worked through that. Mm-hmm. What did you learn that is the most important to success, not just for you, but for other teen parents?
Well, for one, I believe that success is self-defined. And I do see myself as successful, but I do think that there are a lot of other teen moms, teen dads out there who may not have reached the same educational level as I have or the same level in their career where they have found some success. But I think one of the key ingredients of that was grit. I was determined not to give up. And when things were a struggle for me academically in high school, just trying to find childcare, trying to find someone who I felt comfortable leaving my child with so that I can go to school and get an education, those things were a struggle and I had to figure it out. And I refused to give up. I was sharing a little bit about the benefits cliff with Dr. Watts before we came up here. And I was talking about how when I was able to by a miracle, graduate from high school on time and was offered entry into St. John Fisher College. I was notified by my caseworker, my DHS caseworker at the time, that I no longer qualified for a child care subsidy because I was going to a four-year institution and not a two-year institution. Now, for many people like me in that same circumstance, that was the end of the road for them. They may not have had family members or some sort of support system around them that could have helped them to continue their education.
They would have not gone?
They would not have been able to go for many, many reasons. And the child care provider that I had at the time, I had built a really close relationship with her. She was somewhat like a mom, and she decided to watch my son for me for $40 a week. Now, I don't know where you can go and get quality child care for $40 a week. It's not available. And she provided that. She was that protective factor for me that allowed me to continue my education until I got a job and was able to pay her, you know, a decent salary for the quality care that she was giving. But there are so many people who fall right off that benefits cliff because their support stops and then they're not able to go on. And that's something that we really need to address in this community.
That needs to change?
Absolutely.
Who can change it?
Well, it's all about legislation, it's policy. It's not just at the ground level. It really is at the top. Through my organization, Connected Communities, we work very closely with the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, and we consider ourselves to be a community quarterback working in the Emma and Beechwood neighborhood to alleviate poverty. But there are only so much that we can do on that ground level, at that grassroots level. We work very closely with our MAPI because we see them as the offensive line. They are working on policy changes. They are working on ensuring that lawmakers understand the plight of people who are on the ground, and they're changing the circumstances by changing the rules of the game. There's only so much that you can do when the rules of the game are set up against you. It's really set up for people to fail. If you make $10 more per month in household income and it cuts benefits that are worth valued far more than that, then it really puts a person in a very difficult position. It's not that people are lazy and they don't want to be successful, but sometimes the system has been set up to keep people from being successful.
And you see, this is where I wanted to ask you about what people get wrong about poverty, because as you say, you're not only drawing on your own experience mm-hmm. as a former teen mom, staring at poverty, dealing with those challenges, you're now working with people in various parts of Rochester, and you're working occasionally with lawmakers or legislators who have to make decisions. What do they tend to get, and this isn't to indict them, but what do they tend to not understand or maybe get wrong or assume incorrectly about poverty?
That this idea of picking yourself up by your bootstraps is really the answer to changing people's lives. You know, I've heard, you know, as I go and I do talks all over the place talking about Connected Communities and our goal to really impact the neighborhoods that we're working in, and folks would say, how do you convince people to really want a better life for their kids? How do you convince them to work harder? And it's, you know, and, you know, I'm always perplexed when I get questions like that, because just ask anyone who's in the neighborhood walking down the street what they want for their kids and what they want for their futures. Everyone wants better for themselves, for their families. It's not a matter of, you know, someone being too lazy. And it's not to say that there aren't people in the community, in all parts of our community, urban, suburban, rural, who perhaps aren't, you know, doing some of the right things. There are people all over the place that are doing things incorrectly, but there are a lot more people in the neighborhoods that I work in that are working very hard and are diligent about taking care of their children and being involved in their children's education. But when I'm concerned about putting food on the table versus coming to a neighborhood meeting, or, you know, even being concerned about picking up trash in the front yard because there are so many other issues that are plaguing my family, I mean, you choose. What would your priorities be?
But, you know, LaShonda, there are, I don't think this is a political observation. As you said, it's the bootstraps comment. Pick yourself up by your own bootstraps. Choose success. Choose advancement. And, you know, some people who have that sort of disposition might hear your story and say, but you said the most important thing for you was grit. And my concern would be they didn't then hear the next part, which is, okay, you were determined. You were not going to let this, pregnant at 14, derail your life as best you could. But you still had, I would use the word, the privilege of having somebody for $40 a week to take care of your kids. When so even though you had the grit and this determination, you still occasionally had supports that other people in your position might not have had. Is that fair?
Absolutely. That is absolutely fair to say. As I mentioned, you can't go anywhere and get quality. And that's the key, quality daycare, because folks are not just leaving their kids with any old body, and this was someone that I trusted. Had this been an offer from someone who I didn't trust, that whole education for me would have been out of the window. And so, yes, it does take supports. It does take assets around you that can help to lift you up. Again, the ideal of picking yourself up by your bootstraps, that makes one think that one single person can navigate these systems single-handedly without any support from anywhere and still be successful. And even those folks who have that mentality that I did it by myself, I would question whether or not they have actually gone back and thought about everyone who's opened a door for them and who has provided an opportunity for them to be successful. There are few opportunities within our neighborhoods for people to be successful. If it's not one thing, it's another thing that's coming in and really knocking folks down.
All right. So one more question for LaShonda. We're going to open it up. And listeners, by the way, if you want to call the program as we talk about poverty, our assumptions, what we can learn at the Many Faces of Poverty conference coming up, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. LaShonda Leslie Smith is the executive director of Connected Communities Incorporated and telling her story. So what do you want to make sure people walk out of your event with on Friday the 28th, LaShonda?
I want to make sure that people are challenged, that they are beside themselves as they hear information about poverty and really challenge their own concept of thinking around poverty, really question their own implicit biases, really recognize the role that we all play in continuing to perpetuate this issue that we have in this community. I do believe that if folks sit in that keynote and they listen to all of the speakers very intently, that they will be challenged. And if they are not challenged, they have not been willing to really examine their own selves and their community at large and really ask the question, what can I do to play a role?
You can see why they wanted LaShonda to give this, because it's such a compelling personal story. But it's also, I think, just my own observation is listening to you tell the story. The concern that often conservatives, not always conservatives, but usually people of privilege of various backgrounds have, is that if we just tell people you can't do it on your own, then they won't have the grit and the determination. And what you're saying is acknowledge reality, acknowledge, you know, what doors are open and closed and how we can change that. But also you're telling a story of determination and grit. And then I don't think you would have gotten through what you got through if you didn't have that as well. It doesn't mean you could do it all on your own, but you still had that. And it sounds like you still want people to have that drive.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, LaShonda Leslie Smith is going to be speaking as the morning keynote, I Am the Face of Poverty, and there are a lot of breakout sessions. And let me just ask Dr. Leslie Myers, the superintendent of Brockport Central School District, who has been in the business of educating for how long now, Dr. Myers? Let's see here. You're
25 years.
25 years. So how much have you seen poverty change? Is it more concentrated? Is it more acute in your 25 years in this work, or you know, how would you say it's different today?
I think what's interesting is that I've worked in four different, very different school districts. So I started in the Rochester City School District. So there I saw urban poverty and I saw a lot of generational poverty. Moving into suburban and rural areas, it's I often see situational, some generational, but rural poverty. And so when we were initially talking about the conference, I had initially said, let's just solely focus on rural poverty. And as we began to hash this topic out, we said, you know, no, it really does need to be the many faces, because you can't really pinpoint and just say it's just rural poverty or situational or generational. So I've seen it really play out in very different venues. I think, again, with this conference, what we want people to understand is that you can't fit poverty in a box and apply a one-size-fits-all approach to it. It really is very differentiated, and it's very intense. And, you know, why this means so much to me as well is that I grew up in Pittsburgh. Most people know that. We lived in a $200,000 home, and we were on welfare for a period of time. And so people think they can just do a visual scan, and they can tell that, oh, you look like you're impoverished, you look like you're not. And that to really open up people's understanding, as LaShonda stated, and really help people to understand that there are many facets and aspects to poverty. This really is very personal for me.
It's very easy to assume, isn't it?
It is.
You know, based on house you live in, mm-hmm. based on, you know, any observations we may have.
Correct.
Who are the kinds of people who are already signing up for this conference, and who do you want to be there on Friday the 28th?
Certainly we want educators, all different kinds, not just in public, private, charter, parochial schools. We want individuals who hail from nonprofit organizations. We've also, it's my understanding, we've invited some politicians because, as LaShonda said, it's not just a boots on the ground effort, but we need individuals who oversee policy and law to come. We want our higher education partners, obviously, to be there. And we want both high school and undergraduate and graduate students to attend. So it really is, you know, I know this saying has been overused, it takes a whole village to raise a child. But in this case, when you think about poverty, it takes everyone in our community coming from different backgrounds and experiences to have common understanding about this and really make a concerted effort to work to reduce and hopefully eventually eliminate poverty.
We're talking about the inaugural Many Faces of Poverty Conference. It's Friday, April 28th from 9 to 3 at the College at Brockport's main campus in the Seymour College Union. Tickets are $100 and registration is still open. You can do that at bcs1.org/manyfacesofpoverty. Easy to find. And before I jump to your phone calls, I want to ask Dr. Watt to tell us just a little bit about what the Institute for Poverty Studies is. What, you know, it's got a pretty clear name to it, Dr. Watt. But tell us, especially now in the context of what's happening, we've talked, LaShonda talked about our MAPI, these broad-ranging efforts across our community. What do you think the role of the Institute is right now?
So it's probably best to start and discuss a little bit about our mission, which was simply to better equip the College at Brockport faculty, staff, and students to understand sources of poverty, and then in doing so, be able to contribute to poverty alleviation in their communities. So our mission is to provide as many different opportunities so that students at the College at Brockport, when they graduate, will have some ideas on what their responsibility is in addressing poverty alleviation in their communities. If we think about 80% of the College at Brockport students staying within a 100-mile radius of the college, then we are able to be a part of the poverty alleviation efforts that are headed by our MAPI and many other people. And I just want to tack on to say that LaShonda's story, she referred as being a 14-year-old mom in the 1990s, but it's very much alive and current today. About 60% of the city of Rochester's the poverty rate for female-headed families with children under 18 is it at about 60% in the city of Rochester. And if we look at our 8-county region, we're at 42.5% for female-headed households living in poverty. That's a lot of people living in poverty. This is not isolated to a story here and a story there.
Okay, and so when it comes to this upcoming conference, do you want educators to walk out of there better equipped to understand how to work with children who may come from impoverished homes, to maybe disabuse themselves of assumptions they have had about what it means? Is this about a structural fix adding to that, or is it sort of all of those things?
I think it's all of those things, but there's also opportunities to really examine one's own assumptions, mm-hmm. Which is really, really important. Sometimes we can be knowledgeable, but not necessarily be able to see our own assumptions. And so Dr. Jeff Lynn will be talking about how we can think critically about poverty and the poor and to examine your own assumptions and evaluate these complex issues, because it's not as simple as understanding. So just one little plug is that there will be an experiential piece to the conference. I'm not going to say what it is because there needs to be an element of surprise. But we can only learn so much cognitively. We have to sometimes step in. So there will be that opportunity.
Okay. And talking about Dr. Jeff Lynn's presentation, one thing that would be interesting to me is just learning about the federal government's poverty guidelines. How much do we actually know versus what we think we know? And then there's an article about the common myths of poverty that they're going to be exploring. So really good to kind of open up our own assumptions and sort of examine what we've got right and maybe what we don't. Jonathan in Rochester is first on the phones. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I've gone through a lot of different levels of income, growing up. But one of the things, as I started working, I realized that, the way our society is structured, you really need transportation. And not having transportation, I don't mean public transportation, because it just doesn't go enough places. And I think that's one of the things that concentrates poverty, is people not really having access to move around. But I'm thinking that, there needs to be some kind of program to help people who need a car, something like this, because I think that's probably the biggest key, aside from education, of course, but I just think that's one of the biggest keys to, helping people really get out and up from their circumstances. And I know there's times I was like, man, I wish I didn't have to spend so much, not only on a car, but on insurance and all this other stuff that kind of goes along with it that makes it almost impossible for really people to get out of this kind of never-ending cycle. I'll hang up and listen to you guys. Thanks.
All right, Jonathan, thank you. Thoughts from our panel on that?
Sure. Thanks for that comment, John. When I worked in Ithaca, we were 155 square miles, and it predominantly is a very rural area. And one of the initiatives that we launched a few years ago when I was working there was a rideshare program, because we often complain in education, parents aren't coming to our events. And of course, we plan them according to our schedule rather than theirs, but that's another story at another time. But we paired up individuals who had access to transportation, and we had a sign-up board where we would post all of our major events, so parent-teacher conferences, curriculum nights, and even events like an athletic event. And people clustered around where they lived, and they actually ride-shared so they could get transportation to participate at school with their children. And that was really, really productive and very positive. So transportation absolutely can be a barrier, especially if you don't have access to public transportation. And think about some of the more rural areas that are in Monroe County. I think sometimes those areas get forgotten. So transportation certainly is critical when you look at it through a pre-K through 12 educational context.
LaShonda, how often does that come up in your work and the people you're working with?
Every single day. I was going to say the caller was spot on. Transportation is a huge issue. Even if you do have access to public transportation, think about getting groceries or, an emergency. There's so many different things. Or that job that's outside of, the locations that our local transportation company will go. The Mayor's Office of Innovation is piloting a van pool program that should be able to address some of these concerns, because even if you do have access to a vehicle, trying to maintain insurance, the repairs that are required for a vehicle long term are significant. So we're hoping that the van pool would be able to really address some of those concerns.
All right, you're hearing LaShonda Leslie-Smith, Executive Director of Connected Communities Incorporated. You just heard Dr. Leslie Myers, Superintendent of Brockport Central School District. Dr. Celia Watt is here, Professor and Chair of the Department of Public Administration and Director of the Institute for Poverty Studies and Economic Development at the College at Brockport Metro Center, and Lisa Robusto is an event coordinator at the College of Brockport Metro Center. They are here because the first annual, the inaugural Many Faces of Poverty Conference is coming up on Friday, April 28th from 9 to 3 at the College at Brockport. And when we come back, we'll get back to your phone calls. Matt in Rochester, Stephen in Rochester will take your calls. And I'd like to work through more of the breakout sessions coming up here. Lisa and the panel are going to be able to tell us more about what we can expect coming up here if you're going to be attending the upcoming Many Faces of Poverty Conference. It's all coming up on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Earl Woods told anyone who would listen 20 years ago that while his son had, yes, just won the Masters by 12 shots, Tiger Woods would be remembered not for what he did on the golf course, or at least not primarily, but for what he did off the golf course, changing the world, more than Gandhi, more than Mandela. Well, it turns out Tiger never really wanted to do what his dad said he would do. Does that matter? Do we put too much pressure on them to change the world? All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let me grab another phone call. This is Matt in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I'd like to start this off by saying that, you know, every child's a gift from God, so, you know, we'll leave that at that. But, you know, maybe back in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, contraception and all that wasn't available or frowned upon, but you have generation after generation of poverty seeing what it is having a child out of wedlock or being a young teen having a kid. And, you know, you go to the store, condoms are, you know, $10 a box, or schools give them away for free. So, I mean, you see all these children seeing their parents, the struggles they went through. So it's almost like you know that it's going to be an issue for you, how bad it's going to be trying to provide for these children, yet you don't take the step to alleviate that little bit of problem. I mean, you have all these stuff stacked against you, when for a few dollars you can actually prevent another thing to deter your progress.
So Matt, you feel like, you know, you're blaming the kids who are having kids, or you know, are you?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not blaming the kids. Everybody, you know, enjoys, you know, the activity. But growing up and seeing, you know, the struggles that your parents had, maybe being a single parent at a young age, you should be able to kind of see, you know, how to prevent that.
So you're saying if you're 14, if you're 15, and you're...
The alternative is just buy a condom or birth control, and a lot of that's readily available.
Okay. Matt, stay there. I'd like you to stay there. LaShonda, you want to start? What do you think?
Sure. I think sometimes we make the assumption that as a teenager, we're really rationally thinking through all of the possibilities that can happen if you engage in an intimate experience with the opposite sex. And I can tell you, it never even crossed my mind in a million years that I would end up pregnant. I think a lot of teenagers are like, yeah, that's not going to happen to me, with pregnancies, with STDs, with all sorts of concerns. And so that's number one. Teenagers are not necessarily rational or thinking about the future, and that doesn't matter what socioeconomic status you come from.
I agree with that, but you know, like I was saying before, maybe the 1950s, but probably from 1980 on, I remember I'm 35 in fifth grade, you know, having the AIDS video, like they showed like a little cartoon. We had sex ed, you know, that was 20 years ago. I mean, it's not like it's nothing, you know. This is 2017.
Where'd you go to school, Matt? Where'd you go?
We've come a long way with sex education, and you know, it's not like the baby brings a store. Kids know where babies come from now.
Yeah, okay, but where did you go to school, Matt?
Rush Henrietta.
Okay, you know, you don't think growing up, you don't think kids now, you don't think students now are having unprotected sex?
What I'm saying is, in
Rochester,
we're so much more educated that
Penyan.
It should almost be a second thought with the education and how prevalent, you know, Planned Parenthood is and school nurses giving out free condoms. And like I said, you know, a generation ago, I'll admit my mother, she even had a child. I think she was 16. She gave it up for adoption, you know, back in the 70s. I mean, like, we've come so far from that point that shouldn't be a struggle anymore. It should be something that's common knowledge.
All right, Matt, thank you. Common knowledge is that teenagers are having sex and always did and always will. Common knowledge is we've got to fix poverty, access, you know, services, etc. And I don't mean to belittle your point, Matt, but you seem to be saying teenagers in the 1920s might not have known, but teenagers now that they've had that 70, 80, 100 years, well, it's different teenagers. And teenagers do this kind of stuff in all districts. I'm not exactly certain of the point other than to blame them, but LaShonda, what do you think some of the answers are going forward here to try to, I mean, we've seen a reduction in the rate of teen pregnancy, but how do we do even more here?
Yeah, I do agree to a point that teenagers are now more aware, and districts are providing condoms, and we need to continue to educate young people. But more than just educating them about protecting themselves, we need to really give them some hope beyond what they're seeing in mainstream media, to really want to practice really good, safe behaviors. Sometimes kids are engaged in risky behaviors because there's not a whole lot of risk there for them.
Because they don't have a whole lot of hope.
Exactly.
I mean, how many times have we heard these stories that, you know, sometimes people start doing drugs. Why do they do that? Because they've lost hope. So, Matt, I mean, people engage in risky behaviors if they're not really seeing better outcomes. If it doesn't seem that risky because life is already rough. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to learn from someone like LaShonda and not judge teenagers who are in those positions. Also, this notion that schools are handing out condoms. Every time a school district talks about doing that, you've got half the community that freaks out about it. You know, so I actually don't know. Dr. Myers, I mean, I don't know how many school districts are doing that. Do you know offhand?
I sit at the Monroe County Council of School Superintendents. That is nothing. That has not come up as far as districts, many districts doing that.
So most districts are not, right?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Not to my knowledge.
All right. So Matt, I think there were some assumptions that were maybe incorrect there, and maybe a really well-intended phone call from Matt. But isn't that, Dr. Watt, a good example of how our assumptions might not square up with reality?
Exactly. You know, I wish I could say that human beings are completely rational, but we aren't. Even adults make decisions that are sometimes risky. We drive a little fast because we're running late to work, or we drink more alcohol than we know that is good for us. So we make decisions all the time. I'm not saying we in this room ever make those decisions, but people make decisions all the time that aren't necessarily based in a rational basis.
Okay. Well, I think the spirit of the call, you know, we're all looking for good outcomes. I think everybody wants good outcomes. And that's the question is, you know, what's reality? How do we start moving in a better direction on poverty? The Many Faces of Poverty conference is coming up. And I want to ask Lisa Robusto to kind of walk us through the day. So if you decide you want to register, you want to be there on Friday, April 28th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the College of Brockport for the conference, what's the day look like?
So we have a really well thought out day, and it really speaks to what we've been talking about as far as it takes a village and the support and resources that are available in the community. We talked earlier about the breakout sessions. We do have 10 breakout sessions that people can choose from when they're registering. It's not only the College at Brockport or the Brockport Central School District. We also have people speaking from the Rochester-Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, clinical consultant for the Monroe County Office of Mental Health. We have someone from the Midwest Bilingual Education Resource Network and the Counseling and Community Works. So those are all pieces of our breakout sessions. And when you arrive, there's the keynote by the lovely LaShonda, who has been speaking today, and then the breakout sessions. Dr. Watt had mentioned earlier about the experiential part of the afternoon. And then in closing, after lunch, we are having a closing panel discussion. And the participants for that, we have Jay Rosecup. He's from the Wayne County School Climate Transformation. Denise Quamina, she is the administrator at Wilson High School and a leader in our community in implementing trauma response practices in schools. Dr. Sean Nelms, he's the superintendent of East High School. And Melanie E. Stevenson, she is the Assistant Superintendent for Instruction and School Improvement from North Rose Wolcott. So that's how we're going to be ending the conference, with a closing panel discussion to really reflect on the breakout sessions and have a really well thought out discussion on resources are available and what everybody can do starting tomorrow.
All right. Sarah on Twitter responds to Matt's phone call by saying that sex ed definitely needs to be revamped and contraceptives more readily available, but that's not a substitute for lifting people up. We can't blame the kids when the system they're in is broken. That comes from Sarah. So let's talk a little bit about some more of these breakout sessions that you've got a chance to attend. And Dr. Watt, I could go down the list and just pick any one of them, but I'll let you pick the next one to talk about here, because there's a lot of options. Now I put you in a bind there. You've got, go ahead.
You know, one of the ones that is timely right now is We Lost Everything, Urban Poverty and Refugee Resettlement. Mm-hmm. Dr. Pilipa Asara Carroll is an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at the College at Brockport. And this has been her career of research, and she makes many contributions in this area, and it's something that's on a lot of people's minds right now. So, I mean, if I'm looking at the ones that, you know, I mean, obviously I'd like to go to all of them, but if I'm thinking about something that's a really important current event, I think about that, although all of them are. I think Dr. Meeker's Trauma-Informed Care in Action will be a very important presentation as well. Honestly, I feel like I can't choose.
Yeah. I understand the point. I mean, poverty and perspective. What can I do? That's the principles of trauma-informed care in action. Learn together, lead together, work together, turning high-poverty schools into high-performing schools. Can I ask Dr. Myers about that question? Turning high-poverty schools into high-performing schools, the push-pull on this discussion, this debate, is this idea that you really can't do that until you start to bring the level of poverty down. In other words, fixing schools has to start with fixing poverty. Can you have a high level of poverty and still have hyper, and maybe it's totally unfair for me to even ask that question. I don't mean to offer sort of a bias of low expectations. I'm just trying to look at reality and ask, how realistic is it to have high performing schools that have a high level of poverty?
Respectfully, I'd submit that it's a both and. That you need to work on eliminating or reducing poverty, but you also know that you have several students and their families who are in poverty. So there are just simple things when you look at systems and structures. So how are we handling homework with students? You know, I think about being in elementary school and being assigned the diorama project, right? If you look at some of those projects that come through our doors, they are a lot of money is poured into them, you know, with all the props. Sometimes there are electronics that are involved with that. And we need to be mindful of the fact that not all families have the resources to purchase all of these things for their projects. If you even take a simple concept of some of our families, and I think about this with my own mom, when I got to middle school, she was a junior high school dropout. She couldn't help me with my homework. And so making sure that we have resources that are available during the school day or sandwich them right before or right after school where students can get help. I think we also need to realize that certainly that if students come to school hungry, it's going to be difficult for them to do the reading, writing, and arithmetic. And so programs such as backpack programs and ensuring students have food to eat once they leave school because they're well fed when they're at school. And I've seen this play out in my school district. We, on Fridays, pack students' backpacks up, and they are asking, I just want to make sure that I can take this home to my mom, to my brother or my sister. So they're being selfless, and they're really making sure that their family is fed. You know, we have break, what's called spring break that is coming up, and we are making sure that there are supports available for students. So when they're away from school for 5 or 6 days, that they have something to eat. I think probably the most powerful experience that I had working and living in the Brockport community was the visit to the Brockport food shelf. I wanted to go and experience that. I arrived about 20 minutes after they opened, and 13 families had already been through in 20 minutes. And just to see how many students probably benefit from those particular resources. So we have to be aware, and when we think about the hierarchy of needs, those basic needs, of food, shelter, and clothing for students, that needs to be met, and then we can focus on the teaching and learning.
But you think you can do it? It's yes and.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is no excuse.
All right, let me grab another phone call. On the subject of expectations, this is Jawad in Rochester. Go ahead, Jawad.
Hi to all the guest speakers, and it's a great topic. I grew up in a city as well and did go to city school. I did go to RIT, and I think it was my teacher's motivation and expectation, I believe, that made a difference. And that's what I, in a way, realized, that students who have positive role models and teachers or other mentors who expect things from them, like expect them that they will be able to achieve things in life and expect them that they will get out of poverty and they will have great futures. I think those students behave differently, I noticed, because they know that they don't want to put someone down or they have, you know, positive outlook in life than students who, for instance, don't have anybody expecting them to turn out to be any good. So I think that kind of feeds into their psyche and they kind of tend to do things that are more negative as opposed to their counterparts. And I think that kind of feeds into the psychological mentality that leads to, for instance, teenage pregnancies. If a student does not expect anything out of their life, then, you know, they'll just do things that are, you know, according to them, like a whatever mentality, as opposed to, you know, their neighbor or even their classmate. So I think that should be addressed. And, we need to have good teachers who sets a high standard for the class and students and motivates them.
All right, Jawad, thank you for the phone call. Thoughts from the panel. Dr. Watt, is there a concern if we have, are we injuring kids and their potential by having lower expectations based on circumstances at times?
I do believe that there is a piece of, if possible, people rise to the bar, so to speak. But that's not always possible. There are always circumstances that have it such that it's too distracting to meet the bar. I think this conversation, to me, hits what you alluded to earlier, is having hope. If students have hope, I think they're able to focus and not let the distractions steer them off their courses. However, sometimes we have to borrow hope, and who we borrow that from on any given day might be a teacher, it might be a peer, might be a sibling, or parent. And I think that losing that hope is when people start to engage in reckless behaviors, like the caller said. So there's a combination of, yes, where is the bar set, but what is we also don't want people to become demoralized if they're not able to hit that bar. So that's the other side of that.
Well, Jawad, thank you. And we've touched on LaShonda's opening keynote. We've touched on some of the breakout sessions that they'll have at the Many Faces of Poverty Conference. And I know Dr. Myers wanted to make sure we mentioned that the closing panel is going to offer, I think, a strong finish to the event. What are you looking forward to there?
What I'm looking forward to is providing tangible examples of being able to provide services and helping students or individuals address the fact that they are in poverty. So they will give real life examples when people say, well, what can I do? Or there are not these particular services available. So each one of our panelists are really prepared to give tangible, practical, real life examples of how they are exactly addressing poverty in our community.
Success stories.
Yes.
Do we sometimes focus on how hard this is so much that we miss some of the success stories, Dr. Myers?
I think so. I'm very much so one. I like to operate in the symbolic framework of even celebrating small successes. And I remember when I was a high school counselor working in the city school district and a student who was struggling financially, economically, I would say, you know what? You just made it through the week. Congratulations. And I think what was so amazing is the power of just a powerful, hopeful, encouraging word to an individual. And what broke my heart is some of my students would say, that's the first time somebody said that to me. They don't call you by your last name. They would say Miss, right? That's the first time someone said that to me. And just the power of telling someone, you can do it. I believe in you. It's going to get better. We're going to get through this. And there is the light at the end of the tunnel. I think too many times we don't think that will make an impact. And I have students who come back to me year after year. You just don't know how much you encouraged me with the words that you spoke over me. And even though maybe I didn't necessarily believe it at the time, eventually it began to materialize for me, and thank you. So just being hopeful and positive.
Ms. Dr. Leslie Myers, Superintendent of Brockport Central School District. We already heard a remarkable story a part of it. You're going to hear a lot more of it from LaShonda Leslie Smith, the Executive Director of Connected Communities Incorporated. Great seeing you. Thank you for being here as well. Our thanks to Dr. Celia Watt, who is the Director of the Institute for Poverty Studies and Economic Development at the College Brockport Metro Center. Dr. Watt, thank you.
Thank you.
And Lisa Robusto, who is an Event Coordinator at the College Brockport Metro Center. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
If you want to get tickets, you can still register for the upcoming Many Faces of Poverty Conference. It's Friday, April 28th from 9 to 3 at the College at Brockport. Register online. bcs1.org/manyfacesofpoverty. Short break and more connections next.